Okay, I think we'll go ahead and start. Welcome to Climate Change and You. Climate Change Hits Home. And this session is designed to bring you what I like to call shovel-ready stories, stories that you can take back and do right away. My name is Nancy Garter. I'm a reporter and editor at the Omaha World Herald, and I'm on the board of SEJ. We'll be talking about the realities your readers face and your viewers face and listeners in their backyards and how you can better tell those stories, and we hope in a way that's easier for you. SEJ has been thrilled to partner with Climate Matters this year, and this program is part of the fruits of that labor. Ed and Bernadette on the end are with Climate Matters, and Mira and I are with SEJ. This is a National Science Foundation-funded effort, Climate Matters is. So I'm going to start with introductions. Mira is an award-winning freelance journalist and author. You'll find her work in a range of publications from the New York Times to Nature. 3 years ago, she published her first book, A River Runs Again, India's Natural World in Crisis. If you're like me, my gray hair, still learning to tweet, Mira is a great role model for how to use Twitter.
I have gray hair and I know how to tweet.
I wouldn't know about other forms of social media. But she does it well, and through Twitter she's a tremendous voice for building community and for uplifting the work of others. Bernadette is an Emmy-winning meteorologist who has worked 10 years in stations that include cities like Fayetteville, Arkansas, Lexington, and Baltimore. And I can hear my college professor saying, I'm using including wrong. She was at those stations, right? But I bring that up so that you know that she knows what you're going through reporting and writing and broadcasting in a local market. Bernadette is the program director at Climate Central's Climate Matters. She's a terrific communicator, and I'd encourage you to visit the Climate Matters website where you can watch her videos and learn the basics of weather and the interaction with climate in a way that's really easy to understand and really well done. Ed is a George Mason University Distinguished Professor, where he's director of the Center for Climate Change Communication. He helped originate Climate Matters, and I could go on about the many great things he's done to improve communication. But I'd like to point out for your reporting purposes that he was involved in the third National Climate Assessment, which is a primer on how climate change impacts us in our backyards. It's a great book, online tool to read and to understand what's happening in ag and health and roads and energy in your state, in your community. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that there's also someone very important in the room, and that's Susan Joy Hassel. Susan's important in lots of ways. She helped make this happen. She did all the coordination. But also, she's the author of the third National Climate Assessment. And I'm from a red state. I'm from Nebraska. And I wouldn't have been able to tell the story of climate change in my state without the clear thinking and the logical organization of that document. So I thank you, and my citizens thank you, because they appreciate it. And you guys, if you haven't used it, introduce yourself to it. So we're going to start with Mira. Mira, take it away.
All right. Hi, everyone. Lots of new faces. So can we just do like a quick like shruffle? Who here is print journalism? All right. National, local, just shout out. Local audiences? Okay, good. No national audiences. One national. Okay, broadcast? Broadcast radio? Radio folks? Okay, anyone else who didn't want to shout out? What?
Education.
Okay. All right, great. So I'm gonna rattle on about stories. I have been working for the, I cover a lot of different areas, but for the past year and a half, I've been focused on writing about climate change. I was tasked by Inside Climate News to just go out and do a series of stories about how people in the most conservative areas of the country are dealing with the implications of climate change, whether they think it's happening, whether they don't think it's happening, perceptions. It was an amazingly wide leash to just go out and find stories and have them be very narrative-driven. What I went out and told people was that, you know, this story is always presented in the media, not always, frequently presented in the media as being very black or white. You either don't believe anything, you don't trust scientists, or you're crying about polar bears. And we all know that it's way more complicated than that, and it was great to be able to go out and try to find people who were dealing with some direct firsthand things. Actually, I'll start with, this is one of the first stories I did was about the Georgia peach harvest, which failed because peaches need cold during the winter to set their fruit, and it was just never got enough cold hours, so they had a bunch of just stunted little fruit. So I went and talked to fifth-generation farmers to find out how they interpreted that. So let's go to storytelling. Does anybody read Brain Pickings, Maria Popova's blog? It's just wonderful. So she has this great graphic that we all in this room have to be good explainers. We have to be clear in our language and what we're trying to convey to our readers, our listeners, our watchers. So that's the first thing. We all need to do that. Every single journalist needs to do that. The elucidators try to put that information into a context. So trying to get some way to put those facts into the world that we all actually inhabit, because a lot of times the news stories just have limited space, limited run, they're responding to very immediate events, and they don't have time to put that into context. So as much as we can do that, the better. And then what I'm hoping we are all aiming for is this moment of enchantment where we actually just really connect with the people that we are communicating with and get something across to them that sticks with them. So how do we do this? This has all been really interesting, doing this with climate change, because it is such an incredibly polarizing issue that most people do just shut down when they hear it, sometimes if they even just hear the word climate change. I wrote about in that Georgia story about how both basically I didn't want to say anything to the farmers, like, I'm ready for inside climate news. Like, I didn't want to use the word climate. They didn't want to use the word climate. They saw changes. They were making adaptations, but they still did not want to use that phrase. So it's really, really loaded. So how do we tell stories that help us get past some of those hurdles? So being descriptive, you have the ability to capture a place that you have been to and you have experienced. Even if you're not field reporting, you've been there in your head by talking to someone, to a source on the phone, by hearing their stories about their place. So as much as you can be very descriptive about what you're seeing, and get that across to your readers, that's going to be – sorry, I'm a print journalist, so I'm going to keep defaulting to the readers, but just fill in the blank for your media. So the Finding Middle Ground series took me to West Texas. I talked to wind turbine students who were going into wind turbine technology and technicians as opposed to oil and gas, and finding out what their reasons were. Good, stable jobs was the answer, not the burn and bust of oil and gas industry. I talked to dog sledders in Wisconsin who don't have dependable snow anymore, South Dakota farmers who dealt with ranching problems with drought. That was the dog sledding story. So to be descriptive, you need to take them somewhere. And so a lot of the uses of if you have the room for it, creative nonfiction is like word count, where you really have the room. But you can do this even if you don't have the word count. Very quick, strong words about a place. Take them there so that they can really know where they're going. When we think about memories, we almost don't have a single memory in our head that doesn't have a place to it. Like, we are embodied creatures in the world, and so the more that you can help your reader be in a place where the story is taking place, the more that, again, these are all memory techniques to help them remember the story. What are they seeing? What are they experiencing in this place? So paint that scene so that they can step into it with you. And then find your characters. This is becoming more and more prevalent in newspaper writing, that you need people to bring these stories alive. If you just tell people the snow is melting in central northern Wisconsin, that doesn't do much. But if you introduce Mel and Keith Omernick, who are a father and daughter team, and Keith taught his daughter how to had a dog sled when she was just a girl by running around in the summer on the back of a lawnmower with the engine taken out of it with the dogs pulling it. So he got her hooked. They're super close. They live next door to each other. He helps take care of her 27 dogs that she keeps for her kennel. He doesn't think climate change is happening. He thinks it's getting warm now. It's going to get cold again. Mel is an emergency room nurse, and she sees climate impacts and everything from her patients and human health, and doesn't question the science. Incredibly close. Really, really close couple. So, I mean, not couple. They are a couple of family people. So how do they, you know, and you're coming there as a journalist and you offer a space where you're introducing a topic that they probably veer away from all the time, and you're coming in as a neutral person to try to inspire a conversation. And really interesting conversations come out of that. As much as you can capture that, the tension, the resolution, how they try to work out those things, how they push back against each other, it doesn't always have to be you being the journalist who's pushing. So make those characters come alive. When you go to cover dry land racing, which is what happened in Wisconsin because the snow wasn't dependable, so they developed dog sledding in the shoulder season where they use carts and wheels and bicycles and all this other stuff on dry land. So you go there as a journalist for that race, and then it snows, and the race gets canceled. So then that becomes like, oh, God, you can't even depend on there not being snow. It's just weird weather, right? So the race ends up being that they're all running around in mud. Which then, you know, when Mel talks about, like, what I love is, like, running after the dogs in the snow. It's beautiful and quiet. This, can you see this? She's just covered in mud, like, top to bottom. That is, like, not as, I mean, it's kind of fun, but it's not really what they got into the sport for. So capture all of that. Capture the action. Again, the more that you can... the more that you can make things happen and make it energetic, the more that engages your reader. So anytime you can put in action, and sometimes that's even the action of, like, am I a person who's, like, waving my hands around? Am I a person who's fidgeting? Am I very stable? Sometimes it's just as simple as, like, how people use their bodies and their hands in an interview. Like, it can be as simple as that. It doesn't have to be as thrilling as a dog sledding race. It can just be very simple, but putting that action in is a great storytelling device that makes people alive, and it also reveals a lot about them. Is their leg bouncing up and down? You know, all those kinds of things reveal that. Also, just the zooming. By zooming, I mean think like a videographer. Again, this helps place the scene. The first thing a videographer is thinking about is capturing the whole scene, the wide-angle lens. We're in a classroom. There's no windows. There's 30 or 40 people, all of that. And then zooming in to capture, you know, maybe one individual. And then, again, putting in that action, like, what are they doing with their hands? And you'll notice if you, like, watch little short video pieces, if they show somebody doing something and there's not a close-up of what they're really doing, you're kind of like you just want to reach in. You want to lean in and see what they're doing. So that's your brain. That's how we operate and take in information in the world. So the more you can help your reader do that, the better. So why does this work? This is really amazing to me that they're just making all these advancements about how our brain chemistry works. So if I give you just a list of data points, climate's bad, it's getting hotter, the poles are melting, all these things, you only activate one part of your brain. If we start incorporating the senses in that, if I tell you what the dog's kennel smells like, what it sounds like, what the feel of the cold, the feel of the mud instead of just pure snow, all of those things start activating your sensory cortex. So now you've got two parts of the brain lighting up. If there's something physical, again, that action, if we start talking about tennis, you know, and parts of your brain that would actively be swinging your arm actually light up. The more parts of the reader's brain that you can engage, the more that they will remember the stories. It's just, again, how we embed information in our brains. And also the sense of discovery. Sometimes that's really simple devices, like if you're trying to, like all of us, during a story are trying to figure something out for ourselves. And sometimes we just want to seamlessly present that to the reader as though we're God and we knew that all along, right? But we all know that that's actually not true, and there's been some sort of voyage of discovery for ourselves as we're doing our journalism. If some of that can be revealed, those devices of keep them hanging work. You know, if you can present a question or something that you're looking for in the beginning, the reader gets a little hooked. You know, we all, like, get hooked on watching commercials and really bad movies that we know we should just get up and walk out of, but you just want to kind of know the ending. So that, again, is how these stories work in our mind. It's why metaphors work great in terms of especially talking about science. Metaphors and analogies can be really great because they activate part of your brain that you know and links it to something that you're trying to take your reader to in a new place. It's why cliches don't work, because our brains are just numb to them. They just kind of don't mean anything to us anymore. Don't use them. Or use them and play with them. I just was listening to a story by Ann Patchett, and she starts a chapter with, "The road to hell is paved." It was just like, and then that was the first sentence. So if you write a cliche, like, play with it. Sit with it for a moment and see if you can spin it. This is really important with covering climate because it's become such a knee-jerk issue, kind of on both sides, not just the right. I've been amazed at writing for this Inside Climate News series. I think there was a lot of intention of going into it, of like maybe trying to reach out to more conservative voters, but I think this is equally important for readers of the left. People are like, oh, I didn't realize that evangelicals who are waiting for the end of the world aren't troubled by some of the signs that they're seeing. Like, this fits with the narrative of their stories and isn't necessarily a bad thing. Both sides are missing each other a lot. This, you don't need to look at all this other than to take away that if you are Republican and you're educated, you actually believe in climate change less. So again, data is failing us in this realm. All that said about the storytelling and everything, you as journalists need to know the science. So be rock solid on what – there's so much good information out there. NOAA, NASA, National Climate Assessment, I absolutely agree in terms of finding those stories. When I was tasked to just go out wherever in the country and find them, the National Climate Assessment has regional breakdowns of like what are some of the bigger issues in these different areas. They can help you start tracking down to how those stories might be playing out in regional audiences. So know the science. Great thing about being a journalist is you can be stupid and call up the smart people and ask them to help you figure things out. So that's been super helpful. Embrace multimedia. We kind of have to do it all. I mean, as a freelancer, I'm shooting photographs and not video really, but doing photographs and doing audio along the way. Again, it's just a multiple forms of storytelling. The more ways you can tell the story, the better it will embed. Graphics, again, if you can encourage working with your editors, if you have that kind of support, there's a lot of great open source online data creation tools that can help you sometimes do this, even if you don't have to do it yourself, to pass along to your editors if you don't have a data person in your newsroom. And like, this was a really fun story that I did for Undark, where phenology is like the biological phenomena that happens. And so like spring is happening earlier, fall colors are changing at different times, like across the whole North America, across everywhere. But I was focusing on the North American landscape. So I ended up talking to a biologist who had been using Henry David Thoreau's journals that he kept. Henry David Thoreau walked around Walden every single day, and he noted when every flower was blooming and every bird was arriving, and he did that 140 years ago. So this biologist now is walking around Walden with a notebook and looking at when every flower is blooming and every bird is arriving and seeing like, oh yes, we have moved to 21 days earlier for some species. But now he is teaming up with other people at Boston University, where he's located, who are doing drone satellite imagery. And they're getting, again, this is the zoom lens, right? He's down here looking at these individual flowers. The drone is going up a few hundred feet and looking at the trees. But we have to teach those drones what they're seeing, right? These forms of technology are not actually all-knowing, although we think that maybe they are. So that we have to teach the drones. So they're connecting those levels of information. And then they're even connecting that level of information to the satellite imagery that's happening from, you know, miles above the Earth. So you get to, as a, like, this was so much fun for me to go and work with all these different levels and see how their connections came together and how they're bringing these stories together. So think about different ways that you can approach a story that could be all done right in your backyard. This was all right when I was in Cambridge and really easy to report. I wrote a book about India. Part of it was about cook stoves. Short story, most people in India at that point were still cooking over open fires. There were efforts to use improved cook stoves, which is this one in the corner that she's not cooking on. And so I wrote this story, and years later, Andy Revkin was working at ProPublica and working on cook stoves. I shared with him this information. He went back to this village, and he got a picture of this exact same image with the woman's daughter. So be generous with your stories. I always feel like there's more stories out there. Sharing the information, I feel like, is more beneficial than hoarding it all. I think every journalist has like a gazillion stories. They were just holding so tight because, oh, I can't wait to... And they just don't... There's always more stories. So lean towards generosity. But returning to the scene of the crime, whether it's yourself or somebody else, can be really, really fascinating, I think. Collaborate as much as you can in that same spirit of generosity. Inside Climate News teamed up with other partner publications for a lot of these stories. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution for the Peach story, West Virginia Public Broadcasting for a flooding story, High Country News we did, The New Yorker for the dog sled story. And I think with that, I'm probably, did I do okay?
Thank you.
I forgot to look, but thank you, and that's it.
Thank you, Mira. Very good. Very helpful. And so we'll go to Ed next. And I neglected to mention that Ed helped originate Climate Matters, so very appreciative.
So I have to say I'm a huge fan of Mira's, enormous fan of reading her product. But over the past 3 or 4 months, I've had the opportunity and really the great pleasure to listen to her speak about her craft. It is so enormously engaging and illuminating for me. Before I actually go to the content that I wanted to share with you, I just want to say in response to what you said that we're told that sex, religion, and politics are not the stuff of polite dinner table conversation, and we're told not to talk about them at the dinner table. From you and through other sources, I've learned that climate change is really sort of the fourth impolite topic to talk about. And in part, you know, we have... All of us hopefully have opportunities to talk about sex, religion, and politics at appropriate times, even if it isn't the dinner table. But I would actually contend that we don't all have appropriate opportunities to talk about climate change or global warming. And that's really a problem. And it's a problem that's been very much at the center of my own research for the past 10 years. And as a communication professor, and you professional communicators, you've all heard that the media doesn't teach us what to think, but it does teach us what to think about or tell us what to think about. And I'm going to close by sharing with you in a few minutes that most Americans don't hear the kind of reporting that Mira is doing or that any of you are doing on climate change. They tell us in response to our surveys they rarely hear about the issue covered in the news. And I think that's a real problem because it suggests to them that the discomfort they feel about talking about the issue of climate change, there's a basis for it. If this were really the problem that I deep down am convinced that it might be, surely the media would be telling me more about it. So our challenge is not that most Americans don't understand that the climate is changing, because they do. 7 out of 10 Americans will tell us in response to our surveys, yep, climate, global warming, that's real. The challenge is that they see it as a distant problem. They don't see it as their problem. They see it as distant in time, so more like a year 2100 problem, not a 2018 problem. They see it as distant in space. It's a problem for parts of the world that I know the names, but I really might not even be able to place them on the map, on the globe. And they see it in distant in species. They see it as a plants, penguins, and polar bears problem, but not a people problem, not my problem, not my child's problem. And, you know, all three, you know, we've talked about the National Climate Assessment a couple of times now. The main finding of the most recent National Climate Assessment, which was released in 2016, was that climate change is happening here now in every community in America. And that's a really important disconnect between the way Americans think about the issue and the reality of the issue. So that they accept, almost all of us accept it as real, but it's there's no psychological traction because we don't see it as affecting our lives. This is just sort of data from the surveys that I conduct with Tony Leiseritz at Yale. We ask people, how much do you think global warming will harm you personally, your family, people in your community, people in America, et cetera, et cetera. And the bottom number in dark orange is the people who tell us that they will be a great deal. So 14% of Americans think they personally will be affected a great deal. 17% think their family will be. 17% think people in their community will be. So fewer than 1 out of 5 feel any sense of personal vulnerability to this problem. Conversely, you go all the way to the other end of the slide, more than half say that plants and animals, plants, penguins, and polar bears will be affected a lot. And that future generations, again, the 2100, year 2100 problem, not a year 2018 problem. We've done an analysis of how Americans think, feel, their policy preferences, and their personal actions with regard to climate change, and we found 6 distinct groupings. We identified this about 10 years ago. This is 2018 data. They've changed the proportions of people in these global warming 6 Americas has changed over the course of 10 years. So they have sort of shifted in this direction. 10 years ago, they were more or less there was more or less parity between the alarmed segment and the dismissive segment. In the intervening years, fewer and fewer people have become dismissive of the problem and doubtful of the problem, and more have become concerned and alarmed. But the reason I wanted to show you this is because these people, this 21% of Americans, they tell us that climate change is happening here now. It has come home to roost. This grouping of people, which is the largest segment, they think this is their children's generation's problem. So they see this as a problem of 25 years from now. This group, the next sort of tied is for the next largest group, they see this as their grandchildren's problem. So more like 50 years into the future. The next group over, the smallest of the groups, they simply don't have time. They tell us, I don't have time. I'm really not sure if it's happening or not. So they don't really have a firm sense of when it is likely to manifest. The group to their right is a group who is skeptical, modestly skeptical that climate is changing, but they're still listening. They still retain an open mind. But when I ask them, when do you think people here in the United States will begin to be harmed, they're more like 75 to 100 years into the future. That's how far out they see it. And the group that we call the dismissive over on the extreme right, not happening. Americans will never be harmed by this issue. So if you just sort of march across from the alarm to the dismissive, each of them is seeing this as a further and further issue away from them and the people they love. So the question for you all and the question for us is, well, can we do anything about that? Can we use journalism to bridge this gap, to reduce the psychological experience that people have when they think about global warming or climate change? It's kind of an important question, because if the answer is no, then go write about other things. Go write about something where your journalism will actually make a difference. Bernadette, this was before Bernadette and I had the pleasure to start working together, but her predecessor, Heidi Cullen, who's a climate scientist and a TV weathercaster who at the time was on air in Washington, D.C., Joe Witte, and I decided to try to answer that question. If we helped a broadcast meteorologist report local climate stories from his or her little part of the world, his or her media market, would it help reduce their viewers' psychological understanding, the psychological distance they experience when they think about the problem? So this is Jim Gandy. Jim was a chief meteorologist at WLTX in Columbia, South Carolina, the CBS affiliate. Jim said, I would really like to be the first person to test this question, to help you answer this question. And we were just so happy to work with Jim because Colombia is a tough place to talk about global warming for all the reasons that Mira talked about. It just isn't polite topic of polite conversation in Colombia. But Jim and his news director, Mary Beth Jacoby, I always say her name wrong, and I can't say it wrong in front of Sue because she knows the right pronunciation. They said, yeah, we understand this is a little risky. We understand we may lose some audience members if Jim starts talking about climate change on air, but we think this is the right thing to do. We want to work with you and test this premise. So Heidi and Joe and Jim and I sat down and we planned 12 story topics that Jim said he thought the weather would create news hooks over the intervening 12 months. So we literally looked at the, you know, sort of what the interesting climate change stories would be in Colombia. Jim said, yeah, I'm pretty sure the weather's going to cooperate. We're going to get at least one chance to tell every one of those 12 stories over the next year. And before he aired any of those stories, we surveyed his viewers and his competitors' viewers. So we surveyed local news viewers in Colombia, random cross-section, about 1,000 of them. Jim did his thing. He told his 12 stories, and then he improvised a 13th story. So 13 stories on air over the course of a year. He put the videos on his station's website. He created a blog. You know, it was interesting in so many ways, even during the pilot test, because the worst never happened. The dog never bit. In other words, their viewers didn't start calling the station in outrage, saying, we want that guy's head placed on a pike pole out in front of your station, because that guy is un-American. It just didn't happen. They had almost no, like, by almost no, I mean you could count them on one hand, complaints during that first year. Conversely, Mary Beth tells us that virtually every day of the week she gets at least that many calls about what one of her anchors is wearing, always the woman, of course. So, you know, just keep in context that what a female anchor is wearing generates a lot more negative viewer feedback than 13 stories on air about the local impacts of climate change. And then we conducted a survey at the end of the one-year pilot test. We surveyed the same viewers, and we surveyed a new cross-section of viewers. In both types of data, we found the same, essentially the same pattern of responses. People who watched Jim learned more about climate change. It became a more personally relevant issue during the course of that year than viewers of the competing stations. So the answer to the question, does it make a difference? Can local climate reporting actually reduce that psychological distance? The answer is yes, it can. We were so excited by these findings that Heidi hired Bernadette because she realized, this is important. We're going to take this one little pilot test and we're going to turn this into a big national program. We're going to make these data available to every weathercaster who wants to use them in any media market in America. And the only way we're going to ever succeed in doing this is to hire somebody and put somebody in charge of this program who is actually of the target audience that we're trying to reach. We were so fortunate to get Bernadette, and you will understand why when you hear her speak in a moment. Bernadette has allowed us to go from one weathercaster in 2011 to 602 last count. That's almost one out of four weathercasters in America is now working with us to tell compelling local climate stories, including Elise Raffa, who is with us today, who is just an amazing, amazing local climate educator in Springfield, Missouri.
And Dan,
thank you.
Harrison.
Sorry. So let me just close by giving you just a little bit more, by sort of flagging one tool that you may or may not know about. Dan does know because he mentioned this before. My colleague and I at Yale, we do these public opinion surveys every 6 months. Tony and his team at Yale have taken the national public opinion data and they've learned how to, with great accuracy, localize it, downscale the estimates of public opinion in every media market in America. And every county in America and every congressional district in America, they're called the Yale Climate Opinion Maps. You just have to Google Yale Climate Opinion Maps. It'll take you right to it. I think they've got about 21 different indicators of public opinion, public understanding, on their maps right now, and you can go right down to your area and see what people who you are reporting to think and even their policy preferences with regard to climate change. It's phenomenal. So here's the map that includes Michigan. You can see Detroit over there. It's the one city that is highlighted. I just wanted to, if this is not a polite topic of dinner table conversation, Michiganders clearly believe it is a polite topic of conversation to be happening in their children's classrooms. About 70%, you know, this is the county level data. You can see that the dark red is about 80%. The darker orange is more like 75%, and the dominant color there is about 70%. So let's just say 7.5 out of 10 Michiganders want the causes, the consequences, and the potential solutions to global warming taught in their children's classroom. If this is really something we were deeply ambivalent about or felt shouldn't be discussed, we wouldn't want it taught to our children. But most Michiganders do, and most people in your community, wherever you live, do. I don't even have to show you that map. I just know that is the case. But this is what I wanted to direct your attention to. This is the proportion of people who tell us that they hear about global warming reported in the media at least once a week. I am so far into the nerd loop that I read about global warming in the media 7 days a week, often many stories. I realize I live in a bubble. The average, so here in Michigan, you can see that fewer, that let's just say about 1 out of 4 or 2.5 out of 10 tell us they're reading about it in their media, any media, whether that's local or national, reading about it or hearing about it once a week or more frequently. People aren't getting this reporting, and I think that's really problematic. We surveyed all of you, SEJ members. We surveyed members of RTDNA, news directors, producers, and other news executives, NABJ members, and NAHJ members earlier this year. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about any of that, but I do want to make one really important point about the SEJ member data. Almost all of you, I don't know that you all responded, but almost all SEJ members who did respond, and it was almost, we got a 51% response rate from SEJ members, which is, God, in the survey business, that's pretty darn good. That's one I write home about. God, I got half of them to respond to my surveys, Mom. I feel so good. And here's the most important thing that we learned from you. All of you want to tell, almost all of you said you wanted to tell local climate stories. But large numbers of you said there were things that were getting, there were barriers, obstacles that were making it difficult for you to do so. The two obstacles that I've highlighted were sort of the number one and number three most prevalent ones. Lack of time to get into the field to do what Mira does. She's got a really privileged opportunity for this current series. Pretty much, you know, half of you said, no, two-thirds of you said, I just don't have the time to do it. It's the time is a constraint. And that we hear you on that one. We actually think we have some resources. We know we have some resources that can help minimize the time necessary to do that. And then lack of training in climate science. Climate change is complicated. You don't want to be reporting on things you yourself don't understand. We had a great workshop 2 days ago here, and we had 35 people who, together, 35 SEJ members and a half a dozen really rock star climate scientists to try to, so that you all could get to know, extract from their brains what you needed to learn from them. We're committed to keeping that up in a variety of ways. We're going to bring them to SEJ next year, hopefully, if we can afford it. I can't promise it, but that is our aspiration. We're going to try to find ways of linking you to climate scientists throughout the years through our webinars and what have you, because we recognize you might feel some uncertainty. But in reality, one of my favorite climate scientists, Scott Denning from Colorado State, he says there's really only three things you need to know about global warming. And it's simple. He can explain it in 30 seconds. It's serious. And that takes him more than 30 seconds to explain, but that's what the National Climate Assessment lays out for you. And it's solvable. There are things we can do that will really make a difference. These other barriers that you told us about, the lack of time and space in the news hole, the lack of news management support, and the lack of general management support. Just want to make one comment about the final two. The RTDNA members who answered our surveys, they were actually even more gung-ho than SEJ members in terms of wanting to see these stories told. So it may well be that the SEJ respondents, a quarter of them, felt like they weren't getting the support they need from their management, or it may be a misperception. We went right back to RTDNA and let them know, boy, look at the level of interest that you all have in this issue, because we want them to know that their peers are interested in these, in telling these stories as well. So in closing, people benefit. We know, we have proof in a variety of ways, not just the one study I showed you. We've done a whole bunch more studies that prove that people do learn when they watch or read good local climate reporting. They do learn that this is an issue relevant to them in a way they didn't understand. We've learned that you guys and many of your peers and other professional associations, you want to tell these stories, and we've learned that your bosses essentially support it. They're going to support this kind of reporting. So let me introduce Bernadette Woods-Plackey, who's going to tell you about some really important resources that we've spent a lot of time and a lot of our tax dollars. This is a National Science Foundation supported project. It's our tax dollars that produce these materials so that you guys would have materials that will help you tell compelling local climate stories if you would like to.
Thanks, Ed. No, we're good. Hey, everybody. I just want to start by saying thank you for joining us today and having a packed room. It's just so great to see the response and the energy that people want to do this. So what we're going to try and do is help you tell those stories in any way that we can. And I always like to start by saying this really is a living, breathing program. We want to hear from you. We want to know what helps you tell those stories so that we can help support that. So please know that, and we want your feedback. So a roundup of what we're doing now. Ed gave you the history with TV meteorologists and how we're expanding now to work with journalists with this new grant. Real quick overview, it is a free product for you. We get the funding for it. It is a science-based, localized climate change reporting resource. It is localized in a data sense, and we try to personalize these messages, and I'll take you through that in just a moment. But I really want to highlight the science part of this. Climate Central, for those who don't know us, we're a nonprofit, an NGO, really grounded in science. We're a non-policy organization. So we're a mix of science and communications, but everything is fundamentally scientifically proven in the way that we do this, too. So that is our forefront of everything that we do. That's our approach to climate change, just so you know. We do it in English and in Spanish. So everything is translated there, too. So how do we do this? As I said, focusing on the science first and foremost. And this is a weekly product that we're putting out. So every single week, there's some really interesting conversations of how far you can push the communications of the science between our communicators and our scientists. But this is something we will never stray from the science. We will always try to translate it in more human terms from how you're seeing it in scientific journals. We localize when we can. Now, not every topic is that possible. Scientifically, it's just not possible with certain topics to really bring it down into a level for every single community across the country. But we do that when we can and when we have internal resources to do that too. And we really try to simplify big topics. That's a premier goal of ours, too. We operate on a news cycle. And what I mean by that is those of you understand that you may have a story planned, but something else comes up and you have to switch. We do the same thing. If something's going on in the news that we can connect with or has a scientific climate change angle to it, we will switch what we're doing, flip things around, and try and get that out to you because we get the questions from you and we're trying to respond to that. And we try to stay ahead of the news cycle as much as possible. For example, king tides are kicking in for a lot of the country this month. So we got our coastal flooding information out this week so that you'll have it to prepare for your stories. And then, as we said, this is offered free to TV meteorologists and journalists. As we approach this and expand to working with journalists, we still do our weekly product. And it has always really had a weather focus to it, although we take in so many more topics than just weather. And then on top of that, we're doing this monthly package, which offers some additional resources, those that we've been able to pull so far. But again, we want to keep offering you what you need. And here's an example of that. We have our localized information at the top there. always geared at your particular market. And we do this for 244 cities across the U.S. So the primary TV media markets is where we started, having worked with TV meteorologists. But we've added on additional cities. I mean, I live in New Jersey. There's not a primary TV market in New Jersey, but a lot of big cities. Delaware, same thing. So we've tried to add on some additional cities there. We also offer interview opportunities. Now, on a national scale, we're some of the experts, but we also highlight some ways you can find some local information. For those who didn't see last night, Sideline was here. They're doing a lot of that with local experts. So we try to give you some additional ways to find those local resources for you. And this will change up compared based on the topic that we're doing. So if it's a health thing, as this one had a health angle to it, we worked Ed's other projects that he works on really are health focused. So we pulled some people from his consortium of doctors that we were able to tap into. And we'll switch that up again based on the topic. We try to now offer some free images, and this is an area we do want to build out more, because for those aren't on TV or have to do a digital aspect to this or tweet something out and they want something in addition to the science that's there, there's some additional images that you can pull from too. And since we are short on time today, I'm just going to give you a quick snapshot of some of the types of topics that we take on and how we do this. Now, as I said, we have a lot on weather. A ton on weather. And so we know there's a really strong tie between climate change and heavy rain pretty much everywhere in the country. Even those areas that are getting less rain overall, it's coming down in these bigger buckets. So we've done a lot on state and city trends on heavy precipitation, a ton with temperatures. We've brought out a lot of information, particularly on the west with wildfires. Not as much on the southeast, and that is something we could tap into more. But this is an overall western one, and we also do get into individual western states and Alaska, because there's a lot going on there too. We touch on the health whenever we can, because this is not just a weather story. This is a health story. This is an economic story. Climate change has infiltrated so many aspects of our life. And as one of our colleagues on our workshop on Wednesday said, this is really the story of our time. It is hitting so many aspects of what we're doing. So we try to draw that out how and when we can. Always highlight here the poison ivy, because that was Jim Gandy, our original meteorologist. That's his favorite. We've done a lot with mosquitoes. As I say, we do Spanish too. Pollen season's getting longer, smoke wave days, how that hits your health. And we try to hit on some things that do have not such a heavy tone to them, but actually have a positive tone to them with the renewable energy. And then we just like to have fun with numbers sometimes too. If there's something going on, for example, last September, for those who follow the NFL, it was really hot. And it was the highest all-time temperature at Green Bay. So we did an analysis on all the NFL cities and how temperatures have been rising, and every single one of them is warming. I will always highlight the Eagles, though. Go Eagles. This is hitting a lot of our life. I mean, beer. This is hitting some of the key ingredients that are in our beer. So these are the kinds of stories we try to draw out, and we do this in this regular flow of information. Not every story will probably apply to you, but it'll get you thinking. And there may be something you can do in your community to draw that story out in a different way. So that's really what we're trying to do here, is keep that flow of information. We also have just launched this new tool. It's a wind and solar electricity forecasting tool. It's primarily geared at the meteorologists right now, because they're the ones who forecast, not so much journalists at this point. But we will be building this out into future versions. It really aggregates how much wind and solar electricity has been generated across your market. This has been a year-long programming project that we've just got now. We're super excited about this. And I think it can really change the conversation on wind and solar that's going on around our country. And we had some back and forth. Do I even include this slide or not? Now, you can take a snapshot of this with your phone. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on it. There's a lot of words. I know that. But my point is, there's a lot of stories to be told. That's what I'm trying to convey with this slide. I'll hit on just a couple really quickly. Some of the topics we've got coming up across the top. Even if you're not a meteorologist, you're getting thrown into extreme weather somewhere, whether it's happening or whether it's an anniversary story. We like to hit holidays, sporting events. These are stories you might already be doing in health, agriculture, economy. There is likely a climate change tied to a story you already have covered. It's just pulling that out and connecting the dots for your public. There's some big reports like the IPCC's 1.5 this weekend. It's a big one. And then there's a lot of positive stories in your local communities. People are adapting to this. People are changing their behaviors. And you on the ground in these local communities are in just a front row spot to pull those stories out and tell them. And these are really cool stories that need to be told all over this country. So how do you get this information? Well, this medialibrary.climatecentral.org, this is where we store everything. And this is years of information that we've put up there. So you can pull out things we've done in the past, maybe build it into a longer story or a different story, maybe than something we've even proposed. And in the middle there, you can search it three ways, topic, but also the middle one I just want to highlight. You can search by your city. Now, when you go to your specific city, it takes two or three clicks. That has to do with how we've archived the material to keep the methodology and the science and the explanation connected with the visual. So just know it'll take a couple of clicks, but you'll get there. And then we've got a whole page of resources, stored all of our webinars we've been doing about six a year for the past 5 to 6 years, primarily geared at the meteorologist, but we're expanding into working with journalists more now, so there's going to be more coming that way. And we've got interactives for your online components. We've got reports. We've got Facebook pages you can join to have conversations with us. We've also got these extreme weather toolkits because we've done so much with extreme weather. So if you're thrown into extreme weather, some form or fashion, or there was really good video, so it's on your station, or there was a picture, so that you put it in your paper, here's where you can go to find the quick link to what is going on with climate change and this particular form of extreme weather. Because it's different for each of these. There's different ties and connections. So we lay that out for you and give you tools to help tell that story. Then, how do you get this? Well, if you go to this point on our Media Library page, this is where you can sign up to receive the information, and it will be locally driven for wherever you live. If you cover national news, just tell us where you live, and then you can always find other places on here. Also at the bottom, Climate Matters, if you text that to 345-345, you know, we've gotten kind of advanced with technology now, and it'll prompt you to this section of this page where you can answer those questions, and so we can get that too. It's really simple. Just takes a couple of minutes, and then we can start getting you that information. And like I said, we want to hear from you. That is so critical and important for this to succeed, is that we want to give you what you need to tell these stories. And we have ideas, and a lot of what we have is shaped because of the conversations we've had with TV meteorologists over the year. We offer different formats of visuals because you have to keep your station's look or whatever it may be. So let us know what we can do to help, and resource-wise, we'll see what we can do. Also, if you're working on an individual story that may not have been something we've highlighted, we do those all the time. We love doing that. So just come to us.
Thank you. So thank you, all three. We've got about 15 or 20 minutes left for questions. And I think what I'd like to do, I was going to start with the question, but I think I want to turn the tables and follow up on something that Mira said, which is to spread the wealth. So I'd like to know from you all what local stories are happening in your markets that are climate change driven. And I'll start with one from the Midwest. I'm from Nebraska, and in Iowa, it rains so much in the spring that farmers have a hard time planting. There's so few dry days. So what does that mean? That means they've had to go out and buy bigger planting machines, more costly machines. So that's a climate change impact. And I could list a couple of other ones. But do you all have some story ideas about how climate change is occurring in your backyard? And we're only going to spend 2 or 3 minutes, so pop up. Yeah.
The amount of heavy rain events that we're getting in the Harrisburg, South Central PA region has been increasing to the point where places that didn't flood before are flooding. We're getting these micro flash flood events. We had one at the end of August that flooded out an interstate with cars on it that, to our knowledge, had never flooded before. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a stat listed by our emergency management statewide system that 90% of the floods this year in Pennsylvania are in places that were not designated as floodplains.
And if you were to flash up the slide of Bernadette's, that was an area of the country that's getting a lot more heavy
rains. A lot
rains.
More, particularly the Northeast.
That's available.
Side note, my sister-in-law was caught on that highway, picking up her son from school.
So I was working that day, and within 2 hours, that rain event happened. I left work, I was at home, and it developed within 2 hours. It wasn't raining when I left work, but as I was leaving and going home, it started in 2 hours of pure hell.
And so that micro flash flood, I've never heard that term before.
That's the only way I can really describe it.
That's a great one.
You get the flooding from, like, Lee, historic flooding in 2011, but these small areas that people, you know, you talk to the old folks in the area and they say, oh, it's never flooded here before, never seen anything like this, and it just keeps
happening.
And in Nebraska, we had 2012 for much of the country March of 2012 was a black swan event in terms of the heat, unprecedented heat across much of the U.S., and we had in Nebraska a flash drought, which was kind of a new thing for everybody to experience, our climatologists and things. So anybody else? A climate change impact locally? Yeah.
The story that I'm working on now is really interesting. I was talking to the people at the Audubon Society about it last night, giving some help. We have there's this black vulture. It's a warm weather bird. It's typically in Mexico and South America. And as temperatures are warming, it's living areas farther north. So now I'm in southern Missouri, and now we've got this bird that's living in southern Missouri that never used to really be there before. And this vulture is attacking our cattle. So our cattle farmers are losing thousands of dollars, and these poor cows dying because this bird is attacking them. Oh. And this bird is only there because temperatures are warmer.
That is fascinating.
Super creepy, too.
Is it? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, she was telling me about that, and I was kind of freaked out.
Don't let your children out.
Wait, I'm kind of obsessed with vultures. I thought vultures were scavengers.
They waited until you were dead before they came.
So the bird expert that I spoke to on the phone, she said that this vulture is an aggressive bird. It does go after dead things, but it can't smell well. So they think that that's why it's going after these live calves, because it's confused, it can't smell well, it's in a new spot, and everything's on its own.
That's I'm happy to talk to you more.
Yeah, sorry, right?
Vultures.
We've got armadillos in Nebraska now. I'm like, where the heck are they coming from? Well, from the south, yeah. Other ideas, other stories. Yeah.
I live in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, so nice weather.
Ah.
But our snow is melting off faster, and so the river swells much sooner in the season. So all that water flows out of the state, and we have a very, very, very small river, which in itself is problematic because our economy is dependent on tourism and outdoor recreation. But it also is another problem because with that water flowing so quickly, my region doesn't have very many reservoirs. So there's a storage, in some people's opinion, there's a storage shortage as well. So in these years, whenever the flows all come at once, later in the season, we don't have the storage to keep that water up later in the year. So there's there's impacts to, obviously, to ag, to municipal water use, and to anybody who wants to have fun on the river.
And that Colorado problem is a downstream problem for Nebraska. Not that it all comes back to Nebraska, but because the snow melt is happening at a different pace, that's going to affect our irrigation capacity in Nebraska. So we're really stressed about what happens in the mountain snowpack.
Yeah, well, and it gets complicated, too, whenever you talk about interstate agreements with
right.
water.
Right, exactly.
I mean, then it turns into an even bigger mess.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Anybody else? All right, so we're ready for your questions of the panel. Yes, back in the back.
So just to thank you for a great panel, and thanks for the interactive maps are great. I went to a county in Utah where 50% of people believe climate change is happening, and 60% said they think that CO2 should be regulated as a pollutant. That just blew my mind. So anyway, great tool. But my question is for Bernadette, you know, in some sense what you were showing is like, you know, you can attribute everything in one way or another to climate change, and that raises hackles and skepticism. So I just thought, you know, how do you deal with that? How do you answer that?
Well, you really can't attribute everything. Oh, I'm supposed to repeat
but, you know,
question.
There was poison ivy,
so how looks like presenting everything can be attributed to. We try to draw up the stories that do have a climate change connection. I mean, that's really our purpose. When we do localized data, though, there are places where the trend may not go in the direction that would support warming, or in some cases, the negative trend. We'll give all of that information out and try to give the full picture. We work with a meteorologist in Macon, Georgia. He does so much great stuff, but I feel like it is the place that climate change is not happening because his trends are always in a different direction. So we've tried to work with him with some different stories that he was interested in. But your point to attributing everything, you can't. However, there is a lot that you can. And that's one of the things, even with weather, when you get into those toolkits, there are ranges of confidence levels within different types of extreme weather. I mean, temperature, that takes no problem, really. Both the heat and the lack of cold, because it's decreasing. Heavy rain, incredibly strong tie. I mean, I feel very confident that you can almost attribute in some way, form, or fashion that the heavy rain has some climate change link to it. Of course, there are engineering practices that lead to the flooding, so we usually do our analysis on the actual rain more so than the flooding. And then when you get into severe weather, and for severe weather, for those non-meteorologists, has a specific definition. That is hail, an inch or larger, wind gusts about 60 miles an hour or higher, or a tornado. That's where we have a harder time really being able to tease out what climate change is doing. Doesn't mean it's not happening. It's just our data records aren't as long, and they haven't followed the same path. So when we put stuff out on severe weather, we do call that out, and we've done full webinars on that and bringing in some of the experts like Harold Brooks, who he's like, this is what we're seeing. What we can say, this is where we are, this is what we're looking at, but it doesn't mean nothing's happening. So we try to present it that way. Does that help answer?
Well, you know, and I don't want to take everybody's time, but mine was more sort of a psychological question that you know, you have football games, poison ivy, you know, all these things, and there's some climate link to it. At a certain point, some people become skeptical, like, wow, look at all these things that they're saying are linked to climate change. These people are crazy. You know, it's more of a sort of psychological question, not because, I mean, your guys' stuff is really, really, you know, solid. I know that. And I don't know that there's an answer to it, but do you know what I'm getting at? It's sort of like there's a, for a certain group of people, it invites dismissal to sort of, you know, poison ivy now? Even poison ivy?
It's a little bit philosophical, too, I mean.
I would bring that back to the six Americas. I can tell you for absolute fact that the 9% who are ideologically predisposed to reject the possibility of climate change, they will be counter-arguing with every one of those stories. Yeah. So when Dan, or the 9% in Harrisburg, when Dan goes on the air and does a climate story, they're in their mind, they are totally dismissing everything he's saying. But even the group right next to them, the 12% who are doubtful, they are still open to the possibility. And actually, most of these materials, almost all of these materials, can be used in a completely, you don't have to actually talk about human causation, which is really the trigger point.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to see, for example, that on Super Bowl Sunday, it's been getting warmer, you know, in almost virtually, I think, every NFL city in America. It's been getting warmer on Super Bowl Sunday. And that doesn't even have to be a climate change story. That's just this is what's happening. And to Mira's point about sort of the way the brain works, there's an neuroscientists have an expression, neurons that fire together wire together. So the more that we are changing people's understanding of how their community is working, even if we don't directly tie it to climate change or human-caused climate change, ultimately we are putting in place neural pathways so that when those connections get made, they will be much stronger and more powerfully reduce that psychological distance that I talked about.
And one more point to yours, and we can follow up even in more depth if you want. People are looking, to your point you just said, of how you set this up and prepare people to understand this. People really are looking for someone to give them information. I mean, you see it in Ed's polls. You see it in everything that we have learned. People are dying for someone to just connect the dots for them. What does this mean? And if you just go online, we all know what comes up if you look climate change or global warming. It is very complicated to walk through that if you don't have the background. So, I mean, even scientists, like our TV meteorologists that we've worked with, didn't even know where to find some of this information in the beginning. So this is an opportunity, really, to connect those dots. And we, of course, do try to pull out the stories that do have a connection. And it really has infiltrated so much of our life. It has infiltrated our sports. I mean, look at our summer sports. They're now having to put camps for kids at night. Summer camps are having to rearrange because the heat is just getting to tipping points in some places.
Wildfire smoke.
Exactly. I mean, so this really has infiltrated so many aspects of our life. And there is almost always a climate change angle. It doesn't mean that you're going to hit it every time. But there really are just a crazy number of stories. And that's a big goal with this program, is getting us past this is or is not happening from the 1980s to those stories that are all around us that are very much affecting us in our daily lives.
Okay, so we'll go to the question.
I was just going to ask, so you brought up the climate matters in the newsroom for July, hotter than the cost of the heat. So what were the August and September ones? Just looking back through, I was trying to go through my email and see which ones came through, but which ones were distinctly the newsroom ones?
The newsroom one for August was mosquitoes, with our disease danger days from our workshop, really honing in from scientific information that transmission zones peak in a certain temperature range, and working with some scientists from out of, I think it was Stanford, to really apply that temperature range. Then we did the data analysis for each of the cities of that temperature zone and how it's trending. And again, in some places, it's getting too hot for mosquitoes, actually. But that's the peak transmission zone for those. Then what we did the next month was really the rise of renewables, how renewables are faring in states across America, because in the overall perspective, it's still only a small portion of our energy, but it's really growing in ways, and it's a job creator for so much of our country. And so those were the two. And then yesterday we put out the ones about king tides and coastal flooding.
Yeah, I guess that would be the only thing that I've had trouble distinguishing between the weekly updates and the monthly. I knew about July's, but then I didn't realize August and September had come out too.
And that is good feedback. Thank you. And we'll get on to the questions. Is this is a work in progress.
Yeah. Okay. Sarah? Sarah?
So my question is, the thing that disturbed me the most was that slide you showed about how few people think that they hear climate change news on a regular basis. So, I mean, what can we do as journalists and journalism educators if we're putting out all this great content that people either aren't seeing it or don't recognize it as a climate change story? So where do we go from there?
I do think they're, to some degree, they're tuning it out. I question whether or not we're putting out all this great content. I have no doubt that the people in this room are putting out a lot of great content, but in terms of the news hole that Americans are actually exposed to, I don't do this research, but I have colleagues who do research and show that climate change, you know, the proportion of climate change stories in the news hole, writ large, is well under 1%. And of that, the proportion of local climate change stories is almost indistinguishable from zero. So there's a lot of news produced in America, and very little of it is relevant to climate change. And most of that is political. It's, you know, it comes out around the big sort of policy bursts. So December of 2015, the Paris Climate Agreement, a huge spike in our national news, but it was all essentially political. It had really no bearing on how on answering the questions that we know Americans have, because I asked them this. The two questions that most Americans have is, the skeptical Americans want to know, well, how do you know that this is human caused? And for some of them, it's a rhetorical device just to set up a fight. But for others, it's a legitimate question. Like, you guys are saying this is us, but it just seems implausible. So why is it the experts say this is human caused? And for those Americans on this side of the Six Americas continuum, their fundamental question is, what can we do? What can I do? Both, it's a two-part question. What can I do, and what can we as my community, our state, our nation, our world do? They really, the more than half who are really deeply concerned about it, they really want to get more stories about solutions, because they're plenty, I didn't show you the slide, but they're plenty worried, and they just want to get onto the business of solving this problem.
I make it just a quick add on that. In Nebraska, red state, a lot of our climate stories run inside. And because our editors aren't comfortable enough to know that this is a story that matters and could go on page one, they aren't grounded. And so, and I think also a lot of the really great content, we have fantastic national print reporters and broadcasts, but I think a lot of the really good stuff is probably online, where maybe a lot of average Americans wouldn't necessarily see it unless you're tuned into it and you're already looking for it. So that's probably part of it, the demise of the traditional media.
So my response to your question would be, I sent a note to our wire editor this week after listening to somebody talk about IPCC saying, hey, there's this report coming out. I know we can't tell, you know, in a respectful fashion, this is not just another report. And hopefully she'll put it on 1A, but I don't know. But at least she's got that planted in her mind that, okay, this isn't just another climate report because of the increment. And so we've got about 5 minutes. Sir, you have a question?
I was just going to say, do you think it has anything to do with the kind of stories that Mary's talking about are future stories as opposed to breaking stories?
I think it's the fact that it's climate change is an ongoing,
right.
My personal opinion, ongoing story, and it's not new news. So we've talked about climate for the year.
But that brings up an interesting point in terms of the breaking news versus feature stories. Ed talked on Wednesday's workshop about the amazing lack of connection with climate change about how Hurricane Florence landed. Like the hurricane would have happened anyway, but all these conditions made it a lot more difficult. And so even those ways that breaking news, and if you're regional reporters, if you're local reporters, you're covering breaking news all the time, again, help connect the dots and help connect those layers. And so if there's a Trump rollback happening, that power plant scrubbers don't have to be updated, maybe in that story there's just two lines that helps be the elucidator, right? Where you connect, like, this is a health problem here in our local area because this plant is going to continue to emit. On a global level, that's having implications. You know, maybe it's just like constantly dropping those breadcrumbs for people.
And call your local TV station and newspaper and radio. I mean, it was a reader who was like, come on, Nancy, what gives, that finally kind of got me off the dime. You know, mm-hmm. So I do think that we in the media benefit from being reminded about what matters. Yeah, Tony.
Tony Barbosa, LA Times. I just wanted to ask about graphics and data visualization. I think, as journalists, we cling to these because in our presentations about, in our journalism about climate change, because it seems so authoritative and it's a way to present the information. But I'm just wondering, from your experience, whether readers or audience really engage with like all the various line charts and bar charts and stuff that you can make about how bad the situation is, how does that stack up compared to other things like photo, video, and what do you think is most successful in getting your story across?
I think you need both.
I agree. I think you need both. I think the more ways that you can attempt to tell a story, the better. Yeah, the question was about multimedia and data graphics. You can't rely on either or. I mean, even in peer-reviewed journals, when you're looking at journals, a lot of times as a journalist, I do look at the graphs sometimes, but it just depends on what kind of brain a person has. Some people are definitely going for the videos. Like, I don't know what happened in the last year. Every single story has a really crappy video at the top of it, and that seems to be what people want. So maybe that's the answer. But
I forget, and as Bernadette responds, just a second, take a minute here to text this information at the bottom of the screen while Bernadette gives a...
I'll just say I have my bookmarks and cards here that you're welcome to grab. Books downstairs at the...
Just saying, that's all. I do think you need both because people respond differently, as she said, but also sometimes it's you can get farther in this direction because you set a stage here, and or you may grab someone in because you gave a face, and then you can bring them to this level. So I think we're trying to help spur those ideas and it's grounded in the science so you can go that place. We can't pull a face from every single market across. We don't have the capacity, but that's where you guys come in and can.
So we're ready to go unless there's one more. Go ahead, Ed. Yeah.
Just we really, really, really want you to do this, to text Climate Matters to 345-345. So if you don't want to do it right now before lunch, just take a screen grab a photo, and do it later. But we're going to be, Bernadette and I are going to be crying in our beer tonight if we don't have all 20 of you as new subscribers to this wonderful resource.
And then lunch is downstairs right away. So.
Is that the same number as the website link?
Yes.
Yes.
It takes you there.
Okay.
But thank you guys.
Thank you guys, everyone.
Thank you.